From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Haunted Artifacts. Here's what's happening. Iran threatening the United States again. They're saying that their missiles can hit any ship. It comes amid more tensions between Iran and the United States over new sanctions. Who knows what's going to happen there? The body of missing journalist Jamal Khashoggi was cut into pieces, apparently, after he was killed 2 weeks ago at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. The claim, which was first made to the New York Times earlier in the investigation into Khashoggi's fate, comes after Turkish officials searched the consulate for 9 hours on Monday night. Turkish officials have said privately that Khashoggi was killed in the consulate on October 2nd after he arrived to obtain papers that would have allowed him to marry his Turkish fiancée. Saudi Arabia has previously insisted that he left the building alive. I thought we'd check in with Howard Bloom, our expert on the global brain. Howard, what's your take on this bizarre story?
Amazing. When it comes to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, all may not be as it seems. Far from it. We're told that on the orders of a high-level Saudi intelligence officer, 15 Saudi hitmen boarded a plane in Saudi Arabia, flew to Istanbul, Turkey, and laid in wait at the Saudi embassy to ambush Khashoggi when he came in to do the paperwork necessary to marry his living girlfriend, who, as you said, is Turkish. Khashoggi is a journalist who was once close to, get this, the new young ruler of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and who went to high school with Osama bin Laden.
Jeez.
Khashoggi was so trusted by the Saudi royal family that he was allowed to edit two major Saudi newspapers, Al Watan and the Arab Times. But Khashoggi made a mistake. In 2016, just after Trump was elected president, he criticized Donald Trump. He said that Trump's attempt at closer relations with Russia would also bring Trump closer to Saudi Arabia's arch enemy, Iran, a country that's a Russian ally. Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, were tight with the Saudi royals. Khashoggi's criticism displeased the crown prince. So in Saudi Arabia, Khashoggi was banned from print and media totally. He couldn't print a word. Khashoggi took refuge in the United States and became a regular contributor to the Washington Post. Khashoggi's connection with the Washington Post may have made him a useful tool for the Turks, to his great disadvantage. We're told that Khashoggi walked into the Saudi embassy, as you said, and never walked out. Supposedly, he was tortured, interrogated, killed, and cut up in pieces with a bone saw, all in the Saudi embassy building in Istanbul.
Jeez.
And four of the killers, we are told, were close to Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But where does all of this information come from, George? It doesn't come from American intelligence sources. It comes from the Turkish government, the government of Turkey's dictator-in-chief, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And where do Erdogan's loyalties lie? Not with the United States or the Western Alliance. Now look, on paper, Turkey is a NATO member. But Erdogan has turned his back on the NATO nations. Instead, he has formed a tripartite alliance with, guess who? Russia and Iran. The head of this tripartite alliance is Vladimir Putin. And what is Vladimir Putin's primary goal? To divide and conquer the Western alliance, to isolate the United States, to strip America of its allies. Saudi Arabia has been a close U.S. ally since 1933. So how do you manage to separate Saudi Arabia from the United States? You kidnap and kill a Washington Post writer, then blame it on the Saudis. And you encourage Americans to react with outrage at this crime against freedom of the press. But could Turkey ever pull off a deception like this? You bet. Recep Tayyip Erdogan has a history of deception. In 2016, he aimed to get a parliamentary majority that would approve a new constitution, making him dictator for life, but he fell short of the majority. So what did he do? He pretended that the Kurds had attacked, and he attacked Kurdish villages viciously. That allowed him to toss all the Kurds out of the parliament and to increase the proportion of his followers in the legislative body. But that was not enough to give him the power that he craved. In July 2016, there was a coup to unseat him. He took advantage of the emergency powers to toss over 100,000 people who didn't support him out of their jobs and to jail tens of thousands of them. But who actually perpetrated that coup? I suspect it was Erdogan himself. How could Erdogan's dark ops forces have created the impression of a murder that would separate the Saudis and the Americans? Focus on a Saudi writer for the Washington Post.
That's an interesting theory, Howard Bloom. We'll have to keep watching this one. Thank you. So have you ever taken an Uber? Listen to this story. Uber Technologies recently received proposals from Wall Street banks valuing the ride-hailing company as much as $120 billion in an initial public offering that could take place earlier next year. That's an amazing story. Archaeologists in Italy have uncovered an inscription that they say may show that the history books have been wrong for centuries about Pompeii. Historians have long believed that Mount Vesuvius erupted on August 24th, 79 AD, destroying the nearby Roman city of Pompeii. But now an inscription has been uncovered dated mid-October, almost 2 months later. Well, this year, more than half of all the United States have confirmed or possible cases of acute polio-like illness that can cause paralysis and mostly affects children. Of those, 30 states said that they had cases that were confirmed, suspected, or being investigated, including 15 states that said they had confirmed cases in 2018. In total, 47 confirmed cases and 49 more were suspected or being investigated, for a total of 96. It's a bizarre story. Dr. Gary Ridenour with us. Gary, what's going on here?
Well, George, this is a real mystery tonight. This flaccid paralysis has been around for 3 or 4 years in the United States, and it hits the voluntary nerves in your spinal cord, not up in your brain, your legs, your arms, your face, your fingers, your swallowing, and even your breathing can be paralyzed. And the average age is about 7.5 years, and they've noticed that it comes after an acute respiratory infection in the late fall, and it doesn't leave any good traces. The spinal fluids in some of the children show a virus called A71, but not all of them have that. Most of them have clean spinal fluids, and they don't know what's going on. Right now, they said our chances are 1 in 1 million of getting it. However, India has had 50,000 cases over the last couple of years, which cuts their rate down to 1 in 10,000.
Jeez.
So what we want to make sure is that it's not going to come here. But the problem is, here's what we don't
know. But it seems like it is here.
Yeah, we don't know the cause. Why is there an increase? Why is it reported in countries all over the world? Who's at risk? What are the long-term effects? What's the prevention? And most important, what's the treatment to this infection?
Well, that's a good. It's scary, though, Gary. Why does it affect just children, apparently? Immune?
It may be because this respiratory virus that was out last year called D68 really hit children very hard and put a lot of them in the hospital, and they noticed an association between severe respiratory infections in children and the acute flaccid paralysis. So it's usually you have to watch out for is that about a week or so after an acute respiratory infection, the children start getting weakness in their arms and legs, and you should get them to the doctor quickly to have them checked out for this.
All right, thank you, Gary. Today, Canada has become only the second country in the world to approve for recreational purposes across the board the use of marijuana. Uruguay is the other country. Amazing stories all over the place. Up next, we talk about one of my favorite writers and producers, Rod Serling, his life, work, and imagination, next on Coast to Coast AM. You hear that theme? That's The Twilight Zone, one of my favorite television shows, created by Rod Serling, the genius. And Nicholas Parisi with us serves on the board of directors of the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation, a charitable organization dedicated to preserving and promoting Rod Serling's legacy. He's a former staff writer and editor for Good Times Magazine in Long Island. He's also a musician and vocalist. Back in 2010, his former band, Ariok, released a CD with the Serling inspired title Between Light and Shadow on the Retrospect Records. And his latest is his book called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. And Nicholas, I got to tell you, I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for that very nice introduction.
I thought Rod Serling was an absolute genius, wasn't he?
He was. He was. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And not only was he a genius, but he was a prolific genius. He proved it over and over again. He was just unbelievably productive, and he just wrote so many great shows for television and for film.
One of our friends, Mark Zucree, wrote a book about the Twilight Zone in his subsequent book, The Twilight Zone Companion. He said that Rod Serling used to write most of his shows by dictating in a dictaphone while he was floating in his pool.
Well, he definitely wrote most of his shows by dictating. He did dictate from pretty much from 1955 onward. I don't know if he did most of them in the pool. He did some of them in the pool, but he certainly dictated most of his scripts. And honestly, I don't know how he did it. I don't know how anybody can write that way. But Serling was a rare breed. He was unique, and he was able to do it somehow.
Well, let's go back before The Twilight Zone even started. Tell us a little bit about Rod Serling, who he was. He was a veteran, was he not?
Oh, he sure was. Yeah, he enlisted in the Army the day after high school graduation, so he was, had the patriotic fervor of, you know, having seen, you know, Pearl Harbor, and he wanted to do his part. So he enlisted as soon as he possibly could, and he had this this idea that he wanted to be a paratrooper. He was gung ho on it. He wanted to be a paratrooper, and he got his wish. He was assigned to the 511th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 11th Airborne. And he saw some pretty heavy combat in the Philippines, in Leyte and Luzon. And it scarred him. It scarred him for life. And it affected pretty much everything that he did from that point forward.
Some of his episodes for The Twilight Zone had a war-type personality to them. And did he get that from his combat experience?
Yes. He went back to the battlefield several times before the Twilight Zone, during the Twilight Zone, after the Twilight Zone. So it was always there. It was always part of his makeup, you know, the experiences that he had. So, yeah, there were a couple of Twilight Zone episodes, particularly one called The Purple Testament, which is actually set in Leyte during World War II. So that was as close as he got to literally revisiting his combat experience in the Twilight Zone. And then several other shows, like I said, before and after the Twilight Zone.
He was fortunate to be born right in that golden age of television, wasn't he?
Yes, he certainly was. It was a time when television was obviously the new kid on the block. You know, radio was still king in the late 40s when Rod was first coming up. And television needed writers. It was this vast, you know, I would say vast wasteland. It was a vast medium that was just devoid of talent at the time. And Rod, you know, jumped right into it. And he, as I said, he was so prolific and he wrote so much that he just sent stuff out until finally he started being accepted. And soon enough, he was, you know, his shows were, you know, were all over the place.
Did you have a chance to talk to Carol Serling, Rod's wife?
I did not, unfortunately, no.
Okay,
no.
You would have had a treat with that, quite a person indeed.
I bet, yeah.
Now, with Rod, before he got into Twilight Zone, he was a writer for other kinds of shows, wasn't he?
Oh, sure. See, Rod Serling, I mean, some people may not know this, but Rod Serling was, without question, the most prestigious writer in television before The Twilight Zone. He had written, you know, he won three consecutive Emmy Awards for Best Dramatic Writing in 1955, 56, and 57. Twilight Zone started in 59. So he was at the top of the heap before The Twilight Zone came out. And he just kind of took that dramatic, you know, just straightforward drama sensibility into The Twilight Zone and gave it that little fantasy twist on it.
He was very socially minded, and I think he was frustrated because a lot of times when he wanted to put social things in his writings prior to Twilight Zone, the sponsors went ballistic and always tried to critique him, editorialize, and even control him.
Yeah, that was the big, you know, the big problem that Serling ran into, was that he believed that it's a writer's job to do those things. It's a writer's job to address the issues of his time. And every time he tried to address any issue of any social import on television, the censors would get in his way, the sponsors would get in his way. And it was frustrating for him. And thankfully for Rod, he was successful enough and he had built such a name for himself that they were willing to give him his own show. And he had always loved science fiction. He loved fantasy, science fiction, horror, you know, all that kind of thing. So he created The Twilight Zone because he's always wanted to do a show like The Twilight Zone, but he also was able to take it and say, you know what, I can probably get some of this stuff by if I did it in a fantasy or science fiction setting when it'll be a little less controversial.
Every Twilight Zone episode, Nick, that I recall, every Twilight Zone episode had some kind of social issue or a meaning behind it. It wasn't just a television show with a cool ending. It had a message, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. If it was a television series that just had a cool twist ending, we wouldn't be talking about it right now.
No.
You know, it was always deeper than that. Certainly, Serling's episodes were always deeper than that because he, again, believed that that was part of the artist's job. The art, if it's going to be art, it has to, what he would say is it has to say something about something. And, you know, it had to be entertaining. He did want to entertain, but at the same time, he had to say something about something.
What do you think some of the issues were that he wanted to address in his work?
Well, you know, throughout his career, the biggest issue was prejudice. Rod had this innate aversion to prejudice, and he believed that all evils stem from prejudice, that that's the beginning and that's the root of all of them. So he wanted to address that idea that we have this tendency to look to other people for our own faults. When we should be looking within, we'll blame somebody else instead. And that idea came out constantly throughout The Twilight Zone before and after.
Some of the things that he wrote about, of course, were pretty dramatic, but what do you think has kept The Twilight Zone so strong all these years? I mean, we're talking about 60 years now.
And next year will be the 60th anniversary of the debut in 1959. And yeah, it is, you know, just recently there was a magazine was released, a science fiction magazine, but it was ranking the top 100 television series of all time. And it wasn't just science fiction, it was all television series. And the only black and white television series on the cover was The Twilight Zone. It's the only one that made it. And at this point, you know, you ask the average 25-year-old, they're not going to name any black and white television series, but they know what The Twilight Zone is. It's entered the consciousness just as a term. You know, people know that The Twilight Zone means what you think it means. It means something is off kilter, something is strange, something is, you know, not quite right. And it's lasted all this time because of Rod's messages and because, quite frankly, just because it was so good. You know, it was just so well written, so well produced, so well acted. It was just a first-class production. From point A to point Z, you know, so that's, I think, why it has lasted all these years.
I've got this great letter in my office in Los Angeles from Ray Bradbury, who wrote the script, I Sing the Body Electric, for The Twilight Zone. And it was one of my favorites, and Bradbury had heard about it, and I had written an article about it in what we had, what's called the After Dark Newsletter. And Bradbury just loved it. He said, this was one of the greatest things I've ever seen about my shows, and thank you so much. And so he sends me this letter that I've got, and it's, you know, posted on my my board in my office. But Rod didn't write all the scripts. He oversaw things, but he didn't write. He had some writers like Bradbury.
Sure. No, listen, nobody could write every script. You know, Rod wrote 92 of the 156 Twilight Zone episodes over five seasons.
That's pretty prolific.
That's ridiculous. I mean, nobody writes 92 shows in a five-season period. It's just, it's, you know, and at the same time, he was doing other things, you know. So the amount that he produced is just off the charts. I'm just convinced he never slept. He just never slept from 1950 to 1975. That was it.
He smoked a lot, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he sure did, unfortunately. He was just addicted. He was just addicted to it. Maybe he got that in the war as well, but it was ultimately a big part of his death.
Yeah, absolutely. He had heart issues, and that's what finally did him in. You said that Rod wrote well over 250 total scripts on some of the things he did. I mean, that's amazing. If he wrote 92 Twilight Zones and 250 other the total shows, that's crazy, isn't it?
It really is. You know, when I was researching the book, it's, you know, there's a couple things that are really, really impressive. It's that, well, first of all, yeah, he wrote 92 Twilight Zone episodes. He also wrote 38 of the Night Gallery stories.
Aha.
So if you take those, that's 130 scripts right there. So there's at least 120 other things he did besides Twilight Zone and Night Gallery.
Stay with us, Nick. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with everybody about the Twilight Zone. Nick Parisi with us. His book is called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. I'll tell you what else you're going to enjoy. Saturday, March 23rd in Everett, Washington. So wherever you may live, Portland, Seattle, Canada, come on in. Well, wherever you want to go. It's going to be our first stage show of the year, and of course produced by none other than Thomas Danheiser.
Hey, George, how's those singing pipes?
You know what? I'm thinking of Autumn Leaves as one of my songs next September.
You are going to need them. Saturday, March 23rd, we are returning to Everett, Washington. We have got a great lineup this year. We're going to start off with the director of the UFO reporting agency, Peter Davenport. He's got some fantastic stories and sightings. Then we're going to add Johnny Enoch, who's a hidden symbolism researcher.
I like Johnny. He's a great guy.
Johnny's got a lot of good information. Afterlife expert and near-death experiencer, Danion Brinkley. And we're going to top it off with the rogue scholar, John Hoag. This is going to be one exciting night. We have a live band, audience participation. You will sing some songs, a meet and greet to follow. What else do you know?
And how do you get your tickets? At the historic Everett Theater, simply go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the homepage, click events, or in the carousel reel. That's that section where all those little pictures revolve. You'll see a link there. It'll take you straight to the historic Everett Theater, and up pops the link to get your tickets. And they are going very, very fast. We'll see you in Everett, Washington, Saturday, March 23rd. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, with Nick Parisi with us, Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination, the name of the book. Nicholas, how many Twilight Zone episodes were there?
156.
100, wow. And I know three of them, for example, It's a Good Life, In Praise of Pip, Long Distance Call, were with that guy Billy Mumy, who was that kid that scared everybody into the cornfield.
Yeah, they sure were, yep.
And as a matter of fact, I have a little surprise for you, Nicholas. Billy Mooney's with us. Hello, Billy.
Hey, George. How are you, man?
I'm fine. Nick, hey. There you go.
Hey, Bill. Good to talk to you.
Well, it's good to talk to you, too. It's real good. It's better than talking to a dead grandmother, so.
Yeah.
Okay. You give us the bad man.
Oh, Bill, I'm working for you now. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick, I just need to tell you something, buddy. You're a bad man. You're a very bad man.
Your voice has not changed all that much, Bill. You really
I'm still waiting for puberty to strike. What can I say?
Hey, Billy, you were in three Twilight Zone episodes, right?
Three of the original, and then I was in the feature, and then I wrote one of the UPN episodes, and then we returned to It's a Good Life with Cloris Leachman and my daughter Liliana for It's Still a Good Life back in 2003. So I kind of got six notches on my belt when it comes to the T-Zone.
When you were in those episodes and they were being done, was Rod Serling around there? Was he there?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was on the set when he did his, you know, bumpers and intros. And, yeah, he was definitely around. And, you know, it's interesting because there was no regular cast on the Twilight Zone, so he was the only regular cast member. And every time he was on the set, because you know, he and the producer, Buck Houghton, were really singularly in charge of the vision of that show and wrestled control from network hassling as much as they could. All the heads of all the different departments were always very happy to see Mr. Serling when he was on the set and talk to him about what was coming up in the next episode or so. Usually when an executive producer or creator comes onto a set, you know, everybody gets a little uptight.
Yeah.
So, Irwin Allen's here or whatever. But I recall quite clearly that when Rod Serling was on the set, everybody was delighted to be around him.
Did he talk with you?
Yeah, sure. We went out for margaritas every night. After
yeah, that's right. How old were you? You were a little kid.
I was six, seven, and nine.
That's right. How did they find you, Billy, for these parts?
Well, actually, one of the very first lead roles I did was an episode of a Loretta Young show that was directed by James Sheldon that Cloris Leachman played my mom in. And the director of that show brought me in for the first Twilight Zone, James Sheldon. He brought me in for Long Distance Call, and he also directed It's a Good Life. So having two under my belt, I guess they just, you know, called me up for In Praise of Pip. I was a busy guy. In
the you were.
And, I'm a busy guy now.
What are you doing these days, Billy? What's new?
Well, Angela Cartwright and I have just released our novel, a fantasy novel. I think we talked to you about it when we were first writing it a long time ago, George. On Purpose It's called The Devil Seeks Revenge Against an Old Adversary, His Weapons.
Well, you set yourself with Tom for the show, okay?
Yeah, love to do that. And I'm still a producer on Ancient Aliens, and, you know, I'm playing the real Dr. Smith on the new Lost in Space, so making music, too.
You're the best. Okay, Billy, thanks.
That's it.
You got it.
Bye, George.
Billy Mumy. Isn't that a treat, Nick?
That was. Thank you, George. That was great.
He was. I'd get Rod Serling for you on this show. You never know.
he might call in from the other side.
What inspired you to write the book about Serling?
Well, I mean, I became a Twilight Zone fanatic when I was a kid, 9, 10 years old. I was just mesmerized by the show, and so that started everything. And then really since then, I've just, it's been a very gradual process of becoming aware of all this other stuff that he had written, so much of it that was great. And I just wanted to collect all this information about all of these shows that he had written. And it was just surprising to me that no one had actually done this type of thing where, for example, there wasn't even really a complete list of all the shows that Rod Serling wrote that were produced for television or film, believe it or not. I mean, every list I went to had things missing, had errors, had gaps, whatever. But so that had never been done. So the first thing I wanted to do was I wanted to know exactly what he wrote, for his entire career that was produced in any form whatsoever. So, and then once I did that, I just snowballed from there. I wanted to give some information about these shows. I wanted to present them in a way that, the reader who is never going to see a lot of these shows, I mean, they're not The Twilight Zone, they're not Night Gallery, they haven't been commercially released. I wanted to give that reader an idea of what these shows were about. So, so that was the idea behind the whole thing. And then the book became, it's part that, it's part, videography, reference guide, but it's also part biography and this part, critical analysis of the themes Serling's was dealing with and the character types that he researched and, delved into, and et cetera.
Did you come across anything that surprised you in your research?
I came across several things that surprised me, yes. Probably the most surprising thing that I found was, you may have heard of a particular show. We talked about the sponsors before and how they would, butt up against Serling whenever he tried to do anything that was remotely controversial. Well, there's one show that's particularly infamous in that regard. It's called Noon on Doomsday. It was Rod Serling's attempt to tell some kind of version of the Emmett Till lynching in Mississippi. For those who don't know, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old African-American boy who was lynched in Mississippi after allegedly whistling at a white woman. And this really just destroyed Rod Serling.
Jeez.
He wanted to tell some version of this story. And every time he tried to, he met resistance. Well, I was able to find the actual first draft of the script that Rod wrote before any of these interferences came into play. And there have been several studies of this particular show and the evolution that it took from where it was initially to what aired on television. Well, but none of those studies had the actual first draft, and I just luckily found the actual first draft. And that surprised me because, I'll spoil it for you now, it's not all that much different than what actually aired on television. So this book is going to tell you a completely different version of that Noon on Doomsday controversy story than you've ever heard anywhere else.
November 22nd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. How did that affect Rod Serling?
It devastated him. He was, superficially, he was a Kennedy admirer. He agreed with his politics, and he admired Kennedy. But beyond that, it was just, it really, I came across a letter that Rod had written to his, can't say pastor, but he was a Unitarian for most of his adult life, Rod Serling was. And he wrote a letter to one of his Unitarian priests, so to speak. And he just said how it just took away his faith in humanity that something like this could happen. He felt that we were in dark ages. Where something like this could happen. So it threw him into a dark place for a little while. And strangely enough, what happened was the day after the assassination, he and William Frug, one of the producers on The Twilight Zone, were contacted by the State Department and asked to produce a film to introduce Lyndon Johnson to the world.
Wow.
It was a documentary. They needed a documentary. They thought, you know, listen, we got to get something quick that we can just send to our allies and present to people. So, you know, here's the new president. And so Rod Serling, the day after the assassination, when he was, you know, depressed for sure, flew to Washington, D.C., and began immediately working on this documentary to introduce President Johnson to the world.
So he did that. He finished it.
Yeah. In fact, the people who asked him to do this said, we need this in 5 days. And he and William Frook said, listen, that's not going to happen. We can't do it in 5 days, but we'll do the best we possibly can. And they, you know, as we've said before, Rod was so prolific and he was such a fast writer. He did get through it pretty quickly, and they had it ready. You know, I actually don't know exactly the time frame. It wasn't 5 days, but it wasn't much longer than that.
What is it about black and white television shows that have a different feel than the color shows that we all see nowadays?
Yeah, you know, I could tell you specifically when it comes to The Twilight Zone, I think that one of the things that the remakes of The Twilight Zone have been missing is the fact that it was black and white. The Twilight Zone is black and white. It's just, it had an aspect of film noir to them. Film noir has got to have that black and white, edgy look to them, and
yeah,
that's what the Twilight Zone episodes had. In fact, there are 6 Twilight Zone episodes that were done on videotape instead of film. And when you see these videotape episodes, you see how completely different they look than the rest. They're still black and white, but they do not have that film noir feel to them that the filmed episodes do. And so if you take that up a notch and make it color, then again, then you're completely in another universe, and you're not, for me, you're not in the Twilight Zone any longer.
Well, that's why I think Night Gallery, that came out in color after the Twilight Zone, didn't quite have that Twilight Zone magic to it.
That's one of the reasons, I think, yeah. Yeah, the other reason is that Rod really had no creative control over that series, unfortunately.
Yeah, what was his role?
Well, he created the series. He wrote the pilot film, which was called Night Gallery. It was 3 stories, and it was kind of a movie of the week kind of thing.
And he pitched it. He's the one who probably pitched it to the networks, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. After that was such a success, he pitched it, and they kind of mutually pitched each other, and he did it. So he wrote a lot for the series, and he hosted it, obviously, but he had no say in cast and directing and editing and all that kind of thing. And you see that kind of his absence come up all the time in episodes where you say, oh, you know, Rod would have done this, or, you know, and he didn't have that freedom to do that.
How come he never wrote a book?
Well, he never wrote a novel. He did write, you know, collections of short stories.
Short stories, sure, but I mean,
the closest he ever came to writing anything that was novel length was actually the stories that made up the Night Gallery movie. They originally were novellas. They were long short stories in a book called The Season to Be Wary. But he never had the time. You know, that's the simple answer. He was so busy with television. He wanted to write a novel. He really did, but he just never could get away for a long enough period of time to dedicate to writing a novel.
There's going to be a reboot of The Twilight Zone?
Yes, it's already in production, and it's supposed to be coming out early next year. Jordan Peele, who the director and writer of Get Out, is in charge of it. He's going to be hosting it and producing it. And from what little I've seen so far in terms of trailers and things, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think they may actually get it right to some extent this time.
What's the venue for it? Where are they going to air it?
It's going to be on CBS All Access, so it's not going to be on regular TV. It's going to be a pay, you know, like Netflix or Amazon Prime, that kind of thing. So it's CBS All Access. And the interesting thing about that is they launched this CBS All Access network with Star Trek, with the new Star Trek series, and now they're adding on to that with The Twilight Zone. So it's like they're going way back to get these shows to launch this new network. So it tells you how classic these shows are, that they can be reintroduced to a whole new audience in this way.
Nicholas, wasn't Rod Serling one of the co-writers of Planet of the Apes?
He sure was, and a lot of people still don't are surprised when you say that, but yes, he was.
He didn't really get credit for it, did he?
Well, he did literally get credit for it. On the screen, the credit is written by Michael Wilson and Rod Serling, so he did get co-credit, but ever since the movie came out, there's always been this kind of, you know, what did he really write? You know, what did he really contribute to the final film? And there's been a lot of, you know, misinformation and speculation about what he did write. So that's another thing that I think I clarify in the book.
Some of his shows, whether it was Night Gallery or Twilight Zone, had an air of supernatural to it. What was his belief about that?
he was a skeptic, but he was very interested in it. He was Carol Serling was once asked that question, and I think the answer she gave is the best answer to give. She said that he wanted to believe. He had that. He really wanted to believe that, you know, that aliens had been here, you know, 1,000 years ago, and he was very open to these theories of, you know, the crop circles and, you know, alien visitations and UFO sightings and all that kind of stuff. But he was also a very practical guy, and he didn't have any experience of his own. He never saw a spaceship or anything like that, so he was always skeptical. But he really had an interest in it. And you know, in the early 70s, Rod narrated some very popular documentaries about this kind of thing, you know, In Search of Ancient Astronauts, In Search of Ancient Mysteries, which led to the series In Search Of. And during that time particularly, he really got interested in this thing. But I don't think he ever, you know, went over to the side of being a true believer or anything like that.
Now, The Twilight Zone, there were 30-minute episodes, but I guess minus commercial time, they were about, what, 22, 23 minutes?
24, most of them, yeah, back then. Nowadays, a 30-minute show would be 22, but back then it was 24, yeah, a little less commercials.
That's still a lot of writing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and the amazing thing is how fully developed Rod Serling could write a story and a character in 24 minutes. You know, he often complained about that to some extent, said how hard it is to write a fully developed story in 24 minutes, and then he went out and did it over and over again. You know, so he was able to succeed in a venue that, you know, is very hard to succeed in.
It's very difficult to pinpoint your very favorite Twilight Zone episode because they were all different and they were all great.
It's the show was so, yeah, as you said, they're so different. It's very hard to pigeonhole the Twilight Zone. It covered the gamut from, you know, hard science fiction to fantasy to westerns to comedies to, you know, it went across the board. So, I have a couple of favorites, you know, throw a couple out. My favorite at this point probably is Walking Distance, Rod Serling's first season episode about his kind of archetypal, you know, businessman who's stressed out and wants to go back to his hometown and, you know, relive his youth and go back to an easier, less stressful life.
Was that the Willoughby?
It's just like Willoughby. Yeah, it's kind of a stop at Willoughby is kind of a companion piece to Walking Distance. Yeah, so they're both very similar and they're both among my favorites. And that was a big theme for Serling, was this idea of going back to his innocent youth in Binghamton, New York.
I loved, like I mentioned, I Sing the Body Electric, To Serve Man. That was a classic.
Absolutely a classic. And it's, again, one of those shows that people still know to this day. They know that ending. It's a cookbook. You know, that's forever.
there are just so many good. What was the name of the one where the guy was obsessed with... he hated gambling, and then all of a sudden he was obsessed with a slot machine that kept calling his name.
Yeah, that was called The Fever, and it starred Everett Sloan, who actually starred in Rod Serling's very first breakthrough hit called Patterns on Kraft Theater. He starred in that, and he starred in The Fever, and yeah, exactly. He was against gambling, and he got kind of dragged to Las Vegas, and he became addicted to this one particular slot machine that he thinks is taunting him.
It drove him crazy after a while, didn't it?
Exactly right, yeah.
All right, Nick, stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls next hour, folks. So if you want to chat about Rod Serling, talk about your favorite episode, or just talk with Nicholas Parisi about some of the older-type television programs, check in with us next on Coast to Coast AM.